You and I back together again, midweek Wednesday style, May 3rd, 2023, on Connecticut Today. We open the show lauding voters who spoke up against a controversial climate bill. Landmark Legal Foundation attorney Mike O'Neill talked about the latest from the U.S. Supreme Court. We also had our weekly update from Hearst, Connecticut media editor and columnist Dan Haar. Well, you did it. Yes, you folks out there, in fact, all of us together who bang the drums about this and bang the pots and pans and let people know some of the idiocy and the lunacy that goes on up at the state capitol, along with some good stuff every so often. You, along with us here behind the mics, we did it. What are we talking about, by the way? It's Connecticut Today. Hi, how are you? Great to have you by, as always, every day 2 to 6 right here at WICC, 203-333-9422-333-WICC. Remember that bill we were talking about, Senate Bill 1145, SB 1145, which basically would have cost you and I more if we buy gasoline for our vehicles, if we buy fuel oil? It would have given the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection commissioner basically carte blanche to invoke taxes and enter into agreements with other states and Canadian provinces. That bill, yes, that myself and a bunch of other hosts and a bunch of other people who would get hurt by this, we complained and hemmed and hawed about it, and the bill is dead. It is ding-dong dead. So we did it. You and I together and all the other talk hosts in the state and you people who are concerned about this stuff and, took part in the discussions here as to what exactly is in these bills. You know, it's a lot more info because of time restrictions. I get it. You know, the TV outlets can't really go into this as deeply as we can on talk radio. Even the newspapers, they have a limited amount of space they can use here. So we did it. Lawmakers Monday on the Appropriations Committee would not consider Senate Bill 1145. Now, what they are saying and what some of the committee people are saying is, well, it would have been too expensive. You would have had to spend, I don't know, between $750,000 and $1 million. That's the quote here in this Hearst, Connecticut media story, to hire staffing here. You'd need staff to implement the new regulations. Okay, they can say that. And maybe that is the truth. Maybe Appropriations at Hartford didn't want to say, hey, we don't want to spend $1 million on this new program for now. Now, it's not dead. It'll come back. The desire to have you and I pay more in taxes and still more on gasoline, on diesel, on home fuel oil, to fuel these so-called environmental programs without the General Assembly voting on this stuff when it goes into effect. That's not dead. It is going to come back. But for now, the blame is being put on the money because it would have cost upwards of $1 million, they say, according to this story, to do this. Now, the real pressure here, I think, I know they use the dollar and cents argument, and that may be a valid argument. I'm sure it is, you know, in some way, shape, or form. But I think the real argument here is that a lot of people, courtesy of you people being active and calling your state House member and your state Senate member, listening to us here on talk radio, writing op-eds, I think a lot of people in both parties were saying, hey, wait a minute, you are going to give the DEEP commissioner, the commissioner, whomever it may be, of the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, you're going to give them carte blanche authority to do this stuff without a vote of the General Assembly? Enough of you people put up a stop sign on that. They said, no, 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 no. This is not good. Deep Commissioner Katie Dykes says here had argued that such authority was necessary for the agency to get the state on track toward meeting the economy-wide targets that were approved by lawmakers more than a decade ago and which scientists say are necessary to help avoid the most dire impacts of climate change. Well, you know what? Madam Commissioner, Commissioner Dykes, if you're listening, look, I understand you want to implement this thing, but neither you nor any commissioner in this state, I don't care whether it's DOT, DMV, DEEP, the tax commissioner, revenue services, no sitting commissioner in this state should have sort of this carte blanche authority to say, well, we're going to tax you this much, or we're going to get into an agreement with, Ontario, Canada, and Newfoundland, Canada, without the approval of the General Assembly. We have laws, and we elect lawmakers for that very reason. So good on you people. You see, you can make a difference if you scream and yell loud enough, and I don't mean literally going up there. Well, some people like to. I don't mean literally going up there and screaming and yelling and going crazy and having your head crack open, although, it might help. But, man, I got to tell you, see, this is emblematic of a bigger problem, and I say this all the time. I don't think anybody, a Democrat or Republican in this state, I don't think anybody is flatly against cleaner water, cleaner air, cleaner parks, cleaner state forests, cleaner state preserves. I mean, come on. I mean, that's lunacy. However, what people tend to be against is hearing from the people who govern us, well, listen, we're going to have to charge you X, Y, and Z, or we're going to have to attach this fee or that fee to your gasoline purchase, or to your home heating oil purchase, or to your diesel purchase, or we're going to have to enter into an agreement with some Canadian province or some neighboring state. People don't want to hear that, especially on top of that, with a cherry on top, especially if the people they vote for, the members of the state House, 151 of them, and the members of the state Senate, 36 of them, especially if these implementations wouldn't involve them. They would just involve one non-elected commissioner. So I warned you about this about a year and a half ago when this bubbled up. You know, I said this wasn't going to go away. They're trying to pull an end run, as many people in the General Assembly, especially on the Democratic side. I mean, they try to pull end runs around all this stuff. They're doing it with a budget now. You know, you have some people, some petulant children, who don't understand that we have limits. Now, some of the Democratic caucus understand that, and they're trying to be accommodating. But again, as we've been talking about here, you have this scenario where, well, you know, we have a state spending cap. Oh, that's good. We just won't put certain money under the cap. Just come out and say you don't want to adhere to the cap. But whether it's a state spending cap or whether or not it's regulations without proper debate. I'm not against regulations. We need regulations. But when those regulations do not have proper debate, and when you have some people saying, well, you've got to give a commissioner this sort of power or to be the imprimatur on this because, you know, it's just too tough to get these things going. Well, it's supposed to be tough. Change is supposed to be tough. It is. Change should not be easy. It should involve screaming, figuratively, yelling, figuratively, maybe, maybe not, maybe real screaming and yelling. But change should be hard to make sure that you have taken into account what different people think and the concerns that they hear, whether it's the concerns of environmentalists, of people who care about the climate and the planet, as well as the dollar and cents concerns of regular people who, frankly, many of which are sick and tired of being nickeled and dimed and feed to death in this state. A lot of news regarding on the national scene. We keep you updated here. Connected to the U.S. Supreme Court, we talked about the one-year mark of the release of the Dobbs draft yesterday. We'll get to that momentarily with our next guest. More stuff, too. Mike O'Neill joins us from the Landmark Legal Foundation. Mike at landmarklegal.org. Mike, it's Paul again. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing well, Paul. How are you?
Very, very well, my friend. Boy, a couple of things I want to go over here with you. First of all, I know that you had published something regarding controversy with the nation's, at least one of the nation's big teachers unions here,
right,
and as to what their funding actually goes to and if the monitoring of that funding and the intent may be illegal or not. What do you have on that?
Right. Well, you have teachers unions, and we know how powerful teachers unions are. We know how powerful unions are. Unions are exempt organizations. They're tax-exempt organizations. That means they don't have to pay income taxes, unlike, you know, us normal people, individuals or businesses or corporations all have to pay taxes on their income. These organizations don't have to do this. But there is a but here. And, well, let's think about that. They don't have to pay taxes. They engage in political activity. We see how powerful they are from politics. Just a couple weeks ago, we saw that a union organizer, a member of the Chicago Teachers Union, was elected mayor of Chicago. So we know that they wield incredible power. Well, they're exempt organizations. They wield incredible power, political power, but there's a but here. When these organizations, these unions, engage in political activities and they spend dues money, in other words, money they collect through the appropriation of dues that they collect from their members, they spend that, they have to pay taxes on it. And the question here is, what is the IRS doing about this and whether the IRS is properly overseeing this and properly regulating this issue? I did a little bit of research. We at Landmark did a little bit of research because we're interested in these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And we saw that these major organizations that are exempt organizations like the ACLU, the National Education Association, the AFT, all report political expenditures differently. So what we've surmised is that the IRS is really not doing their job here. They haven't made clear exactly what constitutes a political expenditure that's subject to taxation. So when you see teachers, for example, take the day off or they have the day off via the law and they go out and they campaign for a given candidate. Mm-hmm. Well, that's all well and good, but is there any kind of tax implications that arise when that happens? So it's a really interesting issue about how the tax laws, the political power, big unions all kind of intersect. And so I really encourage your folks, if you really want to read more about it, I have an editorial up on our website, landmarklegal.org, and you can take a look at it.
All right.
So we're kind of delving into that.
Sure. The website is landmarklegal.org. Mike O'Neill, Landmark Legal Foundation, keeping us up to date with stuff that's going on connected to the federal judiciary and also the Supreme Court. Mike, before we get to this possible revisiting of the Chevron case, it's been about a year, right, or it was a year yesterday we had a previous guest on regarding the leak of the Dobbs draft decision that eventually went to overturn Roe v. Wade. Kind of interesting stuff, Mike, over the weekend from Samuel Alito.
Right.
You know, whenever a justice speaks to a news outlet, that's news in and of itself.
Certainly is.
He says he has a pretty good idea of who did it, but he doesn't want to say. What do you think about all that?
Yeah, I mean, he shed a little bit of additional light here. He said he kind of had an idea of who it is, but it doesn't rise to the level, the evidentiary level that they need to go public with the name, to name someone publicly about it. But again, let's talk. It was really a dark episode for the court. We had the biggest issue, the biggest case in decades. I mean, we had a case that was, the entire country was watching the court, right?
Mm-hmm.
And last spring. And what did we see? We saw this malfeasance where this decision, this draft decision was leaked to the public. The Supreme Court had an internal investigation, probably identified the individual, didn't do it to a degree of certainty necessary to publicly name the individual or release it. But look at the damage it caused, right? I mean, and I think Justice Alito talked about this, assassination attempts, intimidation, clearly that the purpose of this, and there was a lot of speculation across the political spectrum about who the purpose of this, why was it done? But I think we can all agree now at this point that it was done to intimidate these justices and to get them to change the outcome of this decision. I think, and the damage really, again, the damage continues to resonate even to through this term and probably will resonate for decades to come.
And the thing that that really frosts me off about this, Mike, is that, you know, this is dangerous. I mean, I guess you still right. have protests outside the homes of the Supreme Court justices. And is it not a federal offense to threaten somebody on the judiciary? Did I read that right?
Yes, certainly. Absolutely. And that's kind of a that is a deficiency on the part of the Attorney General and the Department of Justice to investigate and prosecute these individuals. I mean, obviously, the individual who showed up with the knife at Justice Kavanaugh's house was identified and prosecuted. But these protests are continuing. Now, look, there's a balance here. First Amendment rights. We all have a right to protest. And I believe if you're going to protest the decisions of the Supreme Court or any politician or any elected official or any public official, there's lines to be drawn. We can go in front of the Supreme Court and hold up signs and we can exercise our First Amendment rights. But I think the line is drawn when you're showing up at individuals' houses and the homes. And again, this is unprecedented. These justices have forever, for the entire history of America, have basically been able to lead normal, quote unquote, normal lives. Those days are gone. And again, what is the purpose here? The point is the justices now have a conservative majority and are no longer rubber stamping the leftist agenda. That's really been the turn here. Since we've had conservative majority on the court, we are seeing a systemic attacks on the legitimacy of these justices. We're seeing it day in and day out. In the past few weeks, we're seeing attacks on Justice Gorsuch. We're seeing attacks on Justice Thomas. Justice Alito has been a punching bag for them. These are all attacks by the left to undermine the legitimacy of the court, to either impeach these justices or expand the number of justices. Look, they have an end game. The left has an end game. They're exercising their playbook to a T.
All right. Now, Mike, to finish up here, the people are going to start hearing about the Chevron decision, as in Chevron, the gas station, the oil company.
Right.
I remember when this came down a few years ago, and this was a big deal. But explain to people what's going on here and how really resetting this decision could be with our everyday lives.
Right. This is a big decision. There was a decision back in the 80s. I think it was 84, 85. Chevron versus National Resources Defense Council. It's a famous case where it really kind of set the parameters of agency authority. Now, government agencies are these, like the Environmental Protection Agency, for example, is an agency. It sets the authority of these agencies. And the Chevron doctrine, what it says is that federal courts, it's a directive to federal courts. If a statute can be interpreted as ambiguous, in other words, not particularly clear, then the court has to, by rule, defer to an agency's interpretation of that particular statute.
Sure.
And so the courts were always deferring just automatically to an agency's interpretation of its authority. So it's essentially allowed the administrative agencies, the administrative state, to explode exponentially. And now we're going to have a case where the specific rule, kind of in the past few years, we've talked about this before. I've talked about it on your show before, Paul, where that agency authority, the administrative authority, has been constrained by doctrines like the major questions doctrine. But now what we're seeing, the Supreme Court has kind of really dodged directly addressing this in the past couple of terms. They've danced around it. But now the issue is front and center. Whether the court is going to overturn Chevron is going to be on the docket probably for next term. Obviously, the court just granted cert in this case. Briefing is going to happen this spring and summer. The court will hear oral arguments in the fall, presumably, and the decision will come out next year. So we'll get a big decision then.
So,
not to minimize the big decisions that we're going to get in the next couple of months anyway in those other cases.
Sure. And Mike, the bottom line here is if it's reversed or weakened in any way, the Chevron decision, basically it means our members of Congress, the House and Senate members, have to actually, vote on tough issues and not pull a Pontius Pilate here and wash their hands.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, ideally, what you have is you'll have the legislature doing their job, right? They won't be able to pass the buck to unaccountable bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. Elected officials will have to pass specific statutes giving administrative agencies, and again, all these alphabet soup agencies you see all over the country, will have specific edicts from Congress, elected accountable officials to do their jobs. They won't be able to run rampant, and Congress won't be able to wash its hands. It's going to be a lot more work for Congress. It's also going to be a lot more work for the judiciary. But I think ultimately what you have to have is you have to have the power in the hands of the people who are accountable to the people.
Mike O'Neill, as always, Landmark Legal Foundation. Mike, thank you. Appreciate it. Take care.
My pleasure, Paul.
All right. There you go. Thanks, Mike O'Neill there. So there you go, folks. Kind of interesting that we talked about these two things today. Kind of a parallel universe here, like lawmakers in Hartford realized that this bill didn't have the support to vest environmental policy power in the DEEP commissioner, right? Well, that's kind of what may happen here on the national level with this Chevron case next year. Basically, in plain English, if this case is overturned, it might mean, oh, perish the thought, members of Congress might actually have to vote on tough issues and not say, no, we'll let this agency handle it. We have a tea time. Joining us right now, hey, it's the middle of the week. It's Wednesday. Wednesday's the fulcrum of the week. Yes, we balance out Monday and Tuesday with Thursday and Friday coming up. But midweek Wednesday at this time, we continue once again with columnist and associate editor Dan Haar, following all things at Hearst Connecticut Media. And Dan is going to give us his latest installment of As the Budget Turns. Dan, good afternoon. How are you?
Yeah, good. Wednesday, I guess we have to have a name for it. Wednesday something, over the hill.
I think the boss is actually coming up with that, so I'll let you know.
Okay.
So listen, Dan, we're kind of ambling toward the end of the session here, and there's all this give and taking, and whether it's a three-card Monty scheme or a shell game or whatever. What's going on in Hartford with the budget?
Well, Monday was a big day because we had the last three times every year there is something called the consensus revenue, and that is when the budget gurus that never come out for the light of day produce a report that says this is what the budget was, what the revenue collections, tax collections, are going to look like for the next 3 years. And this year brought a very complex and interesting arrangement. Mm-hmm. And the new, and this is the important one because it reflects the April 15th tax collections, and it also is the last one before they set the budget. So the April 30th, May 1st report is the big one. And what it said was this, and bear with me here because there's no simple way to have this said.
Go right ahead. Right?
Is that the state's gargantuan, gigantic, multi-billion dollar budget surpluses that we've been seeing, especially this year, $3.3 mm-hmm. billion, is dropping by $350 million per year, mm. right? And the reason for that is because the accounts that are the dividends and capital gains from wealthy residents, largely in Fairfield County, are dropping by $500 million a year. It's actually $560 million this year.
Wow.
That is, just between January and now, we said, sorry, we screwed up. It's $560 million less coming in of capital gains taxes, state taxes on capital gains, than we had thought. Now, this shouldn't come as a surprise because we already knew that the markets are down and people have less capital gains to realize, and they make less money. But what it means for the budget is complicated, because while that happened, and you might say, oh, that's bad news, Dan, that's really bad. How are they going to deal with that? Where are they going to make up the money?
Yeah.
As it turns out, most of that money was going directly into surplus to pay for paying down the pension with extra payments.
All right.
At the same time, $200 million a year of other taxes are rising. So in fact, even though we're going to be paying down the pension at a lower rate, we have $200 million a year of other tax money coming in beyond and above what we had thought. And that is the money that is now being fought over.
So now I know, when you explain that to me, Dan Haar, I know why the past budget boss, Benjamin Barnes, he always looked like that he was shell-shocked over something. But the governor's new budget boss, I don't recall his name.
Jeffrey Beckham.
What's your read on him? He seems a pretty stern guy from what I've seen. What are your thoughts on him?
Well, politically, we don't know where he stands. He's a long-time classified employee who became the budget chief appointed because of some turmoil in that office that had mm-hmm. nothing to do with him. And he's a straight shooter. He's a straight budget guy. Lamont is a centrist, obviously. He's certainly not spending as much as the liberals would like, nor is he willing to tax his wealthy neighbors. But on the other hand, he's not willing to give back quite as much money in taxes as the Republicans would like, because he believes that the state, A, does need to invest significantly, and B, more importantly, pay down those pensions. So Jeff Beckham is following that those orders and doing what he's told. But the long and the short of it is that that extra $200 million can't be spent on services because we're already up against the budget speed limit, the cap. We can't spend anymore because the spending in the state increases in spending are set by inflation and or income gains, and mm-hmm. we're at the top. So the extra $200 million, one of three things has to happen.
Okay.
They either have to break the cap and spend it, which is what a lot of Democrats would like to see, or give it back in taxes, which is what a lot of Republicans – tax cuts, which is what a lot of Republicans would like to see. And when, in fact, you just had a report, that's what their budget does. Or Lamont still wants to stay the course and use all available money to pay down the pension, which, of course, acts like a tax cut because for every certain amount you put in, you save a certain amount that you don't have to put in the next year, and it's a lot.
Interesting. Dan Haar joins us, Hearst, Connecticut Media. Speaking of pensions, Dan, I guess you said there's news with the municipal pension systems and some union givebacks. What's up with that?
Yes, while we have been quietly anguishing, not quietly, while we've been loudly anguishing over the state pensions and the teachers' pensions mm-hmm. being out of whack badly by tens of billions of dollars, quietly the municipal pensions have been taking a beating as well. And those municipal pensions were out of whack so much that towns have been paying 25% of all salaries into the pension fund because it didn't do well last year and it's unfunded. So they had a reform. Controller Sean Scanlon, the new controller, got everybody at the table, and Democrats, Republicans, unions, towns, because the state administers this fund, and they agreed the unions are going to have not quite as liberal a COLA, cost of living adjustment, and they're going to have some other minor sort of givebacks. They also have agreed to come back to the table for a new tier two. You remember in the old state, there's 14 employees.
Oh, yes. Yep. I have relatives. Right. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, the municipal employees are still on tier one with the rich benefits, and they've agreed to come back to the table to negotiate more, but they couldn't quite get that deal done. What they did get done was a new arrangement that's going to save $800 million for the cities and towns over the next 30 years because there's some complicated financial stuff that they did. But the main thing for our listeners and readers is that the unions agreed to some givebacks on COLA. The towns agreed to let the unions have a sort of retirement thing. It's called DROP. I forget what it stands for. It's an acronym.
Okay.
But essentially, they can retire, set their retirement payments, but keep working. And so it's a plan to keep people on the job because if everybody retires,
yeah.
there are already more people retired than working in this system, and that's not good.
And Dan, finally, you know, the discussions that you just had with me here and over the past few weeks, it is good that there is a dynamic that you have a centrist governor, like you said, and forces on the right, forces on the left, and, you know, voila, everybody gets around the table. It may not be pretty. It's like that old joke about making sausage versus legislation, but it certainly seems we're getting things done here, at least in the short term.
Well, that's right. This municipal agreement is an example of that. And another example of that is when the Republican budget came out yesterday, everybody didn't just laugh and throw it away like they used to with Republican budgets.
Mm-hmm.
Because guess what? If the liberal Democrats don't go along with Lamont's budget because it doesn't spend enough money on social services, private nonprofit providers for health care, UConn, the state university system, if they don't like the amount of spending and they want to see more spending and they won't vote yes on that budget, suddenly Lamont has a coalition of Republicans and centrist Democrats. So the Republicans suddenly do matter more than they did before politically.
And finally, Dan Haar, what do you make? I mean, we talked about the UConn thing, but what do you make of the Connecticut State University system threats, crying, whatever? Of course, UConn not part of that. But, you know, they ask for more, Dan Haar, but yet the numbers of their enrollment are not quite what they used to be. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, enrollment is down, and they're saying that in order to stanch the decline of enrollment, they need to, you know, they need to have the money that they need to maintain the current services. By the way, that is Ben Barnes. He's the financial officer.
So
he went from being in the governor's office budget office to the state university budget office, so he hasn't quite escaped the headaches yet, certainly not this week. In fact, I saw him at the Capitol today coming stern-faced out of a meeting of the Republican caucus.
Oh,
apparently,
boy.
It must not have. I didn't talk to him, but he was stern-faced, and he was leaving the Republican office. So in any case, there's no easy answer there. Look, enrollment is down secularly because of the number of people of that age group. College age is down.
Mm-hmm.
Enrollment may also be down because of, you know, all sorts of forces. And they want to maintain their services because they don't want enrollment to drop any further than it has to. On the other hand, we're looking at higher and higher per student costs in the subsidy from the state. So there's really no easy answer. And making it all the harder is that the post-pandemic costs, including mental health and things that we realize we should have been doing all along, now become baked in. But the pandemic money has run out, or is about to run out at the end of this year. So it's a very difficult situation, in part, again, because of those budget limits. It's not that mm-hmm. we don't have the money. We know we have the money coming in, but we can't spend it. And the reason we can't spend it is because if we start spending all the money we have quickly, what happened in the 90s will happen again, which we'll hit a crisis. And we know that.
Dan Haar, great explanation as usual. Dan, thank you. Have a great weekend. We'll talk next week. Be good.
Great to be here.
Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it. Dan Haar, Hearst, Connecticut Media Associate Editor and columnist. And you see where he kind of follows, folks, the political realities woven into the spending realities in Hartford.